Hey, I'm Mark Maron with Stu Ellicott and Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 minutes past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Today, Tuesday, time to get back to it, people. Barbara Streisand has survived another Memorial Day. She's got today's liberal agenda ready for us, and the Oedipal struggle continues. George Sr. strikes back at his son. We'll tell you all about his political coup de grace. But right now, I'm joined here in the studio by my friends Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott. How are you two?
We're fine after that great three-day weekend.
Wonderful.
Yeah, we're happy to be back.
Are you?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
She seems a little sarcastic.
No.
I'm being sarcastic.
Are
absolutely.
You? Well, you wanted to stay home? You want to take the month
I
off?
I want to sleep for a week.
A week?
Why not?
I was in L.A. I had a pretty good time. Yeah, I had a barbecue on Sunday.
Heard.
Had some friends over.
Really?
Did some cooking.
What'd you cook?
Cooked a lot of stuff, man. I cooked some pork chops, some brisket, some chicken,
uh-oh,
some Italian sausage.
Damn,
but I'm sitting there, as always, you know, feeling a little emasculated by people who are doing real work in the world. I'm like in my kitchen, whipping up some stuff. I love to cook, you know, so I'm the guy cooking, right? Mm-hmm. And there's some guys fixing the roof on the house next door. And they're up there like, you know, sweat. I'm having a little trouble. My mic's down here. Sorry. I'm just trying to get to stand up.
They're working on Memorial Day, but they're your neighbors, right?
Sunday. No, he had guys Sunday fixing the roof. And, like, I'm in there, like, with a little hand mixer, whipping up some whipped cream for dessert. And they're up there, like, stapling, you know, roofing onto the top. And they got the little classic hits. It was so weird because they do the countdown of 500 of the best classic hits, you know? And I'm sitting there, and every one of them have one of these weird nostalgic things. It's a really sad state of affairs when ZZ Top's Tush comes on, and I'm sitting there going, oh, Tush, I remember when I was a kid and they were playing that song. And it was all good. And then yesterday I decided to reflect a little bit on the idea of what Memorial Day was all about and pictured myself, you know, being shot by machine gun fire. Just so I would know what that felt like in my mind, and I could connect a little bit with the people who are fighting the war, and it didn't feel good. So why don't you, that was a sort of a downer to go. I'm sorry, I'm in the middle of fixing a mic stand. We're having some trouble here. So
you're mulling over being kind of shot to death while you're roasting your brisket, is that it?
No, that was yesterday. On Memorial Day, I decided it was appropriate to reflect on why Memorial Day existed. And the only way I could really do that was to lay in bed wondering what it would feel like to be surprised and, you know, like shot. And it was sad, and it made me hope everybody was doing the best they could. So why don't you fill us in on the latest on the end of the world there, Mark?
Well, the latest on the end of the world actually is not the end of the world, and that is that. And you know, Maron, you were especially critical of the administration on Friday for not getting anywhere near their deadline in terms of naming, the prime minister and the president and the cabinet members in Iraq.
Yeah.
Well, they managed to pull it off. Apparently, they have named, finally, Ghazi Mashal Ajil Ayawar to the presidency. Now, he was the choice, and this gets complicated, folks, so give me a moment. He was the choice of the Iraqi Governing Council, which was appointed by the United States, but was at loggerheads with U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer because Paul Bremer wanted Adnan Pachachi, who was the 81-year-old former foreign minister who had been in exile for some time.
He was also the guy that was president at the State of the Union address. He was introduced by George Bush. I mean, this guy's been in the running for a long time.
He's been in the running for a long time, but now he's actually out of the running. This past weekend was a hail of charges and countercharges between Bremer and the Iraqi Governing Council, who are supposed to be acting in concert, in case anybody wants to know, because the Iraqis were not sitting still for the appointment of Pachachi, period.
Right. So it was sort of like Bremer saying, you know, you guys can have whoever you want, but we want this guy. So go ahead and cast your votes. And then the votes come in, and he goes, maybe you didn't understand. Mm-hmm. You can have whoever you want, but we're really interested in this guy, Pachachi.
Yeah, Bremer threatened to ignore the selection of Yawar. This is over this past weekend. So something obviously changed between the weekend and today, because obviously they're about, 7 hours ahead of us. And Yawar has, in fact, been selected by the council.
And I'm sorry.
But what does that mean, that Bremer just kind of saw reality and is that Iraqis have been incredibly felt kind of very insecure and, you know, marginalized in their own country and kind of very mistrustful? And surely, what else could he do? I mean, if they went with their guy, it would just create enormous sore feeling.
Now, who is this guy who has been chosen? What's his background? He was a sheikh. He is a sheikh of the largest tribal faction in Iraq. Is that the guy we're talking about?
That is the guy we're talking about, yeah.
So he's got a lot of political power over several different religious factions within this tribe, so they thought that he might be a uniting force for
the
Iraqis.
Interesting because he's a businessman, and what I think Iraqis want to do is kind of get the country kind of back together, kind of working economically, and many of them have been very disgruntled that Halliburton has taken so much of the reconstruction and that Iraqis seem to be shut out of making the money. So he's a businessman, he's a very prominent Sunni tribal figure, and most interestingly, he recently criticized what he said was the United States' inept management of Iraq. So he is the figure to reunite Iraqis and make them feel confident the country's going to go in the direction that they will actually have a say in what goes on. I don't see how they could have picked somebody else without an enormous amount of trouble.
Well, Pachachi was one of these guys, I guess, who was an expatriate of Iraq. He was a former Baathist, and there's probably some distrust of him because he hasn't been in the country in, 20 years?
Yeah. He'd been out for some time. But now, you know, Bremer is saying, well, he wasn't really our choice in the first place.
Backtracking?
It's an amazing revision of recent history. That's the amazing part. Here we have a guy who 48 hours earlier said, if you choose Yahweh, we're going to ignore your choice. And now he's saying the guy that we really wanted wasn't our choice in the first place.
He was pulling a Hastert.
Yeah.
He was saying, Yauer, I'm not familiar with him.
Don't remember him.
Even in the running for this? I'm not sure.
Well, it's the... I think it's that at least he didn't make Paul Bremer pull out his, a third candidate. They wanted a sort of a spoiler candidate to try and break the deadlock, which is a little former known general who wasn't...
Nader?
He could have been. That might have been his nickname. No, but someone who had been a commander in the Iraqi army before Saddam Hussein and was later jailed under the Ba'ath Party and tortured. But the Kurds didn't want his appointment because he'd fought against the Kurds. So this seemed pretty inevitable that they've got the guy that the Iraqis want and need, and now hopefully we can, with any luck, we can go forward and start putting other things in place such as laws.
Well, the amazing thing is that this presidency is essentially a symbolic post. The power rests with the prime minister, who they actually named over the weekend, and he is a former CIA. I don't know exactly what his role was with the agency.
He was closely tied to the CIA when the United States tried to launch a coup against Saddam Hussein that, in fact, failed. Those are his ties. But yeah. I love, there's an editorial in the Gulf Times in Qatar over the weekend saying that Iyad Alawi, who is the prime minister you just mentioned, that he's the perfect prime minister candidate because he has the advantage of being equally mistrusted by everyone.
It's amazing.
It's even more so than Chalabi?
No, I don't. But the religious leaders think he's too secular, and the U.S.-led coalition sees him as a critic. And for the anti-Saddam people, he's an ex-Baathist, and ordinary Iraqis say he's a CIA man. So, great candidate.
Has anyone heard from Sistani yet? He's really going to be one of the people they're going to have to get to sign off on this entire operation.
They were waiting for him to wake up. You don't want to wake up Sistani. You sort of want to wait till he wakes up naturally and then hit him with the news.
He seems to be using the Chinese strategy, which is kind of wait until everything's done and then come out and, say whether you're in favor or against.
I'm sure they've been consulting him and his aides behind the scenes, though, don't you think?
I don't know. I mean, if Bremer would risk this kind of breach over a symbolic office, I don't know whether they've actually been sitting down talking to anybody.
I'm just amazed that they would do that. It looks so bumbling. It's so impolitic.
Yeah. It made Brahimi look like completely ridiculous, although now it looks like in the end he is going to miss his deadline by not nearly as much as we thought he might on Friday.
Yeah, we were about to just
jump all over the man.
Still ahead, the president's Palm Pilot. Plus, remember how Bush was going to bring a new tone to Washington? Turns out it was nastiness. We'll give you the details right here on Air America Radio. 19 past the hour. That ought to do it. That ought to wake you up. Back to work after a beautiful, long weekend. I actually thought that I would never have to come to work again. You know, that third day in where you're just like, hey, this would be perfect.
It's amazing, isn't it? It sort of doubles the length of the weekend.
Yeah, and considering, because of the hours we work anyways, we have, every week is equal to 2 weeks because you literally have 2 days. You get up in the middle of the night, you come do the show, that's your work day, then we're done at work and people are coming to work and you're like, I have a whole nother day now.
Yep.
So every day is actually 2 days long. And now, Mark, it looks like Chaney is just as bad as we thought he was. Ultimately.
Well, certainly when it comes to enriching himself, absolutely. Now, Chaney, for those of you who don't know, used to be the boss at Halliburton.
Wait, the boss of Halliburton, the one that has all the defense contracts in Iraq?
Yeah, yep.
That one?
That one. Now, he obviously had to give that up when he became when he appointed himself vice president. Because remember, he was the head of the search committee, looked around and said, well, I'll do it.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, that was his thing.
I know how to do this. I know the guys. I'll bring in my team, and we'll just let the kids sit in the big office, and I'll take hold of the little stuff.
The little stuff, yeah. So he supposedly resigned and put his interests in Halliburton, which are considerable, I might add, in trust until he's no longer vice president, whenever that is.
So this is a guy that, okay, so now it's become, there's some evidence, a bit of email that
yes.
suggests that he sort of greased the wheels to make the Halliburton the only contractor available for all of the jobs in Iraq, all right? So that means that's billions and billions of dollars of that Halliburton's going to make off of these defense contracts and off of these catering contracts and cleaning up contracts and every contract available. So all that money goes into Halliburton. Now, Chaney is detached from Halliburton, financially, but when he gets out, he can go, all right, where's my special account? Is that sort
well,
of...
Well, he put his interest in trust. So as Halliburton grows or makes more money, so too does his trust. Now, he can't necessarily access anything while he's still vice president. And we're not talking about all the jobs in Iraq. Let's be clear about that, or all the jobs with oil. But Halliburton is the big dog
right
over there at this point. They're the ones handling a lot of these contracts. And there were remember, two guys were, if I'm not mistaken, busted and then pled guilty to siphoning money off.
And also jacking up prices.
Yeah, and jacking up prices and siphoning off the difference.
Like on the meals or something, there was an issue about how, each plate of food for the soldiers was like $150 or something.
Something like that. And then there was the whole question of the oil being transshipped, I believe, through Kuwait, and it ended up costing a whole... I mean, it was just a mess. But
the thing I want to understand clearly is that when he gets out, when Dick Chaney reenters the private sector... He will have either a bonus or this trust that you're talking about. But whatever new money that he got Halliburton, you have to assume that somehow he will have access to millions and millions of dollars of it when he reenters the private sector.
That would be my general guess, yeah. And who he told to make this happen? Douglas Feith.
That's Wolfowitz's guy?
Wolfowitz's trusted assistant. He was the one that was charged with shepherding these Halliburton contracts through protocol.
So all these neocons, it turns out, many of them anyways, are completely self-serving and doing this to further themselves and their businesses. Chaney, I don't know about, actually maybe that's a broad statement that I'm not sure I know about, but clearly Chaney is and has always thought to be the guy who was exploiting Iraq for his own personal business future.
Well, yeah, and the email, this email wasn't exactly on everybody's desk the day after it happened. This email has been around for a little while.
It took a while to surface.
It took a while to find it, yeah.
Till that one disgruntled Halliburton employee said, you know what? To hell with this guy.
Yep.
I'm sending this out. Someone's getting this.
Not to mention that, despite the fact that most of the big contracts have gone to Halliburton, and the biggest one was the getting the oil industry back up and running again, went to Halliburton without having to come up with a bid. It just went to, no one didn't have to prove that it could do it best for the best price. The reconstruction of Iraq that this is all about isn't even really going very well. And that, you have to look at Halliburton and how the contracts have been parceled out and how the fact that they're not really called to account, as Henry Waxman, the Democrat, has said, that they're, because they have such a majority of the contracts, that there's no accountability. So they can be behind on stuff. They cannot do it particularly well. There's a lot of opportunity for fraud and graft and abuse. And Iraqis are not getting a piece of the action. And there was a big meeting kind of recently where the guy who was in charge of it all, Stephen Orr, an advisor to the Iraqi Business Center, told a group of would-be contractors, you know, I'm very sympathetic to the challenges that you all face. And they don't think so. They think that the priority has been for everything to go to the Americans, and they're just paying lip service to involving Iraqis. That is an enormous problem.
They've also got to try and, you know, they've got to leave room for the French and the Germans, both of whom want in on some of these contracts as well, as a precondition to approving a UN draft resolution on the future of Iraq.
So we need to find a way, really, of having kind of joint ventures of involving kind of Iraqis with the American contractors, or Iraqis with kind of French and Germans. It won't help Iraqis if the French and Germans get contracts and the Iraqis still have nothing.
Yeah.
How are people supposed to kind of get back and employed and put their lives back together? I mean, all they're worried about now is insecurity, and all of these contracts are not helping them get secure.
Well, it doesn't look like the needs and wishes of the Iraqi people are playing much of a role in anything that the United States, quite frankly, is doing over there. It really doesn't appear as though that many people care all that much. Now, of course, there is going to be the kind of stuff coming out of the administration. That usually comes out of the administration. Oh, no, Cheney had nothing to do with it. You know, in the face of an email saying that he did have something to do with it, I guarantee you, before this day is out, the vice president's office is going to come out and say, no, the email is totally erroneous.
But they're also shameless. They seem to absorb everything. They just figured that eventually people will forget about it. You know, they'll just think, like, even with, you know, Rumsfeld and the Abu Ghraib stuff and all these guys, no matter what they throw at them, no one in this administration has taken the fall for anything, really. None of the big players that have been accused of transgressions within this administration no one's being fired for anything.
You know, I had a discussion with somebody about that, and either that or I was dreaming and had you in my dream.
Yeah.
But I had a discussion with somebody over the weekend about that very fact. That with all of these screw-ups, with all of this nonsense, no one has yet taken, you know, no one's been cleared out of office. Nobody's been fired.
And I can't understand why that is. Is there not enough outrage? Is it because the House is so evenly divided? Is it because what needs to happen? I mean, Cambone, the Undersecretary of Defense Intelligence, or whatever his role
is. I thought he was a goner weeks ago.
Rumsfeld's guy.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it really seemed like he was going to go down. And usually if this were, you know, a fair and just world, which it isn't, or even another administration, he would have taken the hit. No one's taken the hit for any of it.
I think one of the reasons that happens is something that who was the professor we had on last week talking about language?
Lakoff.
Lakoff.
You know, today you pick up the New York Times and you look, and there's senior American commanders quoted in the New York Times saying they're writing new orders to shift the focus of the military's mission from offensive combat operations to protecting a new Iraqi government and parts of the economy while building up Iraq's own security forces. Now, this just shifts the attention onto something that they think they can spin to as something positive. New Iraqi government. We've already talked about for several minutes of, you know, how complicated it was just to kind of name the prime minister and the president. Parts of the economy. Well, you know, Iraqis are not very happy about how the economy is shaping up and how they're being shut out of actually earning any money and getting contracts. So, but senior American commanders, the spin of the day is they're writing new orders to shift the focus of the military mission from offensive combat operations to protecting the government and the economy. So let's get the public's attention on something which is forward-looking and positive, and let's hope they take their minds off the military, which is... that's the kind of Abu Ghraib, that's all of the abuses. They want to control the agenda. That's what they're trying to do.
Well, they're also trying to get this this handover done to, I think, get that out of the way of the political campaign. I mean, the quicker I think George Bush thinks he can push Iraq aside as a less important thing in terms of his being reelected, that's what this whole date is about.
Well, you know, it's interesting because there's now increased speculation that whole thing that Ridge and them, not so much Ridge, I can't remember their names.
Ashcroft.
Ashcroft and them did was A, approved by the White House, and B, done to shift the focus away from Iraq. Coming up, the presidential palm pilot, the latest on the war on terror, and your phone calls about reinstituting the draft. All that plus the liberal agenda here on Air America Radio.
33 past the hour, and it's time for our exclusive look into the President's Palm Pilot for Tuesday, June 1st, or as some of you might know it, as the day after the long, nice weekend. Of course, you know I have a guy in the Oval Office that does some cleanup and taps into the Presidential Palm Pilot and gives us a schedule every day. Here we go. 8 a.m. Wake up. Take Memorial Day flag bunting off presidential bed. 9:30 a.m. Review blueprints for World War III monument. Noon, choose new Iraqi president. Inform next of kin. 2 p.m., replace new Iraqi president. Tell no one until June 30th, except Price Waterhouse. 4:30 p.m., stop using phrase approval ratings. Start using phrase pity index. 6 p.m., 3 days until Harry Potter movie opens. No, tell press you enjoyed the prep school stuff, but tell Ashcroft you disapproved of all the witchcraft. 8 p.m., threatening call to Syria just for fun. 9 p.m., video golf, devise exit strategy for sand trap. 9:30, lights out, note, first day of summer vacation, way too hard. And that's the Presidential Palm Pilot. There you go. There
so
you
was he it. At the ranch?
I don't think so. He showed up at that.
He was in Virginia, right?
Yeah, he was at the Memorial Day event.
Oh my
where
goodness.
He laid down a little of his rhetoric.
A vacation without the ranch. Things are getting serious. He must know he's on the ropes.
I don't know if this is like, is a three-day weekend really enough time to go out and clear the tumbleweeds off of the fences? You know, you need a week for that.
How big is his ranch?
I don't know. And people get mad when we call it a ranch. It's not a ranch.
I'm sorry.
There are no animals there. It's not a ranch. It's an
hacienda?
Spread.
A ranch house compound. It's
crib.
A ranch. Yeah. It's more of a compound with no animals.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Apparently all they have on the ranch is brush. It grows. It's a brush-growing industry.
Maybe we could get him to go on BET one day. You know, they have this show where all these hip-hop
Cribs?
Stars. Yeah, Cribs. Put George W. on Cribs. Here's where I clean off the tumbleweed.
Here's where I hang.
That will be the lowest rating BET ever had.
You're right. Viacom would have a fit. The war on terror is taking a different turn as Republicans in Congress are taking aim at the Transportation Security Administration. That's TSA for short. You may remember the TSA is the agency created just weeks after the September 11th attacks. Its mission is to make travelers safe, primarily through airport passenger and baggage screening. The agency has spent $10 billion over 3.5 years, and it employs, or it did employ anyway, 65,000 people nationwide. Florida Republican John Mica says it may be time to return most of the TSA's functions back to the private sector. The agency has already cut its passenger and baggage screening workforce down to 45,000. Mica says private screeners will do a better job than the TSA. Democrats in Congress, including our good friend Frank Lautenberg from over in New Jersey, disagree, arguing the agency has been underfunded by congressional Republicans almost from the start. Regardless, airports have the choice of returning to private screeners as of November 19th. It's kind of like this opt-out thing.
So this is we're going
to... I'm confused, though. So when you went through the airport to L.A. this weekend and I went to London and back, there are companies... You mean to say they're all federal employees? I thought that they were private.
No. As of not long after... When they created the TSA now is supposed to be screening all passengers, all baggage. Now, this was in the wake of revelations, for example, that a relatively high percentage of the workforce... private workforce, for example, at Philadelphia International Airport, were convicted felons.
Right, that was that company. Was it Ark and Wright or
yeah,
something
was
like
some
that.
Kind of. There were these different private companies. So now they're talking about giving it back. Now you two are world travelers. You guys have experienced. I haven't been up in the air since February myself, but you guys have gone through airports. And Sue, in particular, I'm curious because London generally has a really, really good reputation as far as screening both passengers and baggage. Now, is that a public function or private sector function at Heathrow?
I think it's all private.
It
I mean, the
private.
Government oversees the federal airports, the federal airports, whatever it is, commission, aviation, blah, blah, I don't know what, some FAA or something like that.
Yeah.
Some organization oversees the airport, but it's generally faster. All I know is it's faster there, that they don't make you take your shoes off. That's the main difference between security in Europe and security here. You get to keep your shoes on.
Let me understand something, Mark. So... they're saying they're going to cut back on this government bureaucracy that they created. The Republicans are saying it's a government bureaucracy that was overfunded, all right, and it's to protect us in the war on terrorism, which we're losing. So Republicans want to cut a program to safeguard the American people against the war on terror, which they're fighting and losing, in order to save the government some money and reintroduce jobs into the private sector.
It's even better than that.
Yeah.
Remember that the jobs on September 11, 2001, these same jobs were in the private sector. These were, it was private sector people that let those 19 people get on those airplanes.
Right, and the only part of this that has been moved over into the Department of Homeland Security are the air marshals. The air marshals are within the Office of Homeland Security. The baggage checkers and screeners and the people that, you know, with the rods that check us are part of this.
They're part of TSA, which is also part of Homeland Security.
But let me make sure people understand that, you know, that we are, that, you know, terrorism, the actual terror threat is, according to the government and according to facts, you know, bigger than it's ever been. And since 9/11, 4 years prior to September 11th, there were 8 attacks. 3 years after September 11th, there have been 14. Now, in 2002, there were 7 attacks. 2003, 6 attacks. 2004, we've had one international terrorist attack, a massive international terrorist attack by al-Qaeda operatives in Spain. So that means that's a kind of ominous thing.
I think it also, you know, going back to, you know, talking about the Republicans thinking that it should be cut, it tells us something else, which I think is also a little bit scary, in the fact that this agency was rushed into existence within weeks of the September 11th attacks. Mm-hmm. I think, and could now, you know, all but fade away, shows us that it was somewhat cosmetic and not very well thought out, and could have been a kind of, you know, misuse of an enormous amount of money, and that it could be one more example, I'd argue it is, of the Bush administration trying to make everybody feel safe by, like, hey, we've got this new agency, and we're going to focus on the federal marshal stuff on the airplanes and the airport safety. Everybody think, what a great job this guy is doing to make us all feel safer. And the fact that they can even be talking about phasing it out now shows that we maybe didn't even need it in the first place, certainly not in the way they structured it.
Speaking of phasing things out.
Yeah, or phasing things in, perhaps.
Well, you know, I was one of those people. I'm old enough to have been subject to the draft at one time in my life.
You have to stop saying that, Riley. You keep on saying I'm old enough.
I'm old.
Okay. I was old enough during the Gulf War to immediately, or the first. It must have been 80. What was the end? In the first Gulf War, I was there to immediately get to sign up for conscientious objector status.
You were first in line?
Yeah, I was. Me and my buddy Devin went right down there right when we heard that they might reinstate the draft. We're like, I don't know. I can't do that.
Well, you know, there is now, actually, there are bills in both the House and Senate to reinstitute the draft in the wake of what's going on in Iraq, in the wake of General Eric Shinseki's estimate of 300,000 troops needed.
Fired.
Yeah, they got rid of him. Now we got 135,000 over there, and they're not doing, you know, that doesn't appear to be enough. But there's talk now, Congressman Charles Rangel, who we talked to about this, and Senator Chuck Hagel, decorated Vietnam vet and supporter of the war, unlike Congressman Rangel, both think that the draft ought to be reinstituted so that the sacrifice is spread.
Yeah,
that
so it's sense. Not all a bunch of, you know, a poor or
minority class. People. Yeah, I mean, I saw a thing in my local newspaper that talked about the people in Jersey who had been killed, and you look at these people and you look at their biographies, and these were folks, you know, folks who wanted to get in, had planned on attending college, who had planned on doing these different things, and now they're dead.
Could it ever actually be you know, non-discriminatory? I mean, it's a good point that Charles Rangel makes, you know, that the rich and the poor should go.
Your buddy,
there is
Charlie
a war.
Rangel.
But, you know, if you introduce the draft, what does that mean, apart from maybe kind of a big boon to doctors and lawyers, because wealthy people will have access to saying, oh, my kid's got asthma, he can't go, or lawyers will find reasons to
They're
get people
that
off.
They're saying that stuff won't work, that there won't be deferments.
Really?
We've got the liberal agenda up ahead, and we want to know what you think of reinstating the draft. Would Washington think twice about war if their kids had to fight it? We'll take your calls at 866-303-AAR0-866-303-2270 right here on Air America Radio. 46 past the hour. Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott on Air America Radio. We're taking your calls about the draft. Good thing, bad thing. 866-303-AAR0. 866-303-2270. Sedition at AirAmericaRadio.com. So let's see, who are we going to? David. How are you, David?
Hey, Mark. It's David from Long Island. I was the one last week who told you that that Ascoff thing was all a smokescreen.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And it turns out you might have been right, my friend.
I know. I know. Listen, I think the draft's a good idea. I'm shocked at, like, how apathetic and uninterested people who are 19 and 20 years old in this country are about what's going on in Iraq. If this is supposed to be the new Vietnam, where are all these young people?
Right, like, right.
The draft will wake them up.
Definitely wake them up. You know, just the idea of a draft during the first Gulf War scared me. Thanks for your call, David. I think that's absolutely right, and I think that's a, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why the Republicans are wary of reinstating the draft, is that it would really make people think twice about, you know, preemptive war. That seems to be the big threat to them. But
people, you kind of hope that it would also have to make the government more concerned about whether they were really willing to declare war or not.
866-303-2270, 866-303-AAR0. There are just so many young people that just are not politically activated in any way. And I was one of them. You know, I really would just... because the reason that I was one of them is I'd see Reagan on TV. I'd see other people involved in anti-government kind of things. But when I was in high school or in junior high, you know, it just was not at the head of my...
I think your mic did just go out.
I think it's true that a lot of young people are
I'm back.
Are not as active or not as politically active as they think. Once they get out of college, once all these graduation ceremonies wrap up this summer for those who are students and they get out and they can't find jobs, then they might find themselves being a little bit more politically active. That's generally how it works. Well, you can't help being in a bubble when you're a student.
When I was in college, but it was just in high school, there were just so many other things going on, like, you know, how to make that girl like me. Scott, New York. Scott?
I'd like to see the draft come back just to maybe have enough people to pull the private sector out of the war. There's too much money being made with people providing services to the Army. When and how was it decided that the Army would no longer feed itself or have an Army Corps of Engineers or do any of the things that Halliburton is making all his money doing?
Yeah, that Dick Cheney, you know, enabled Halliburton to make. Thanks for your call, Scott. I think that's another important issue that I misinterpreted initially, was the privatizing of this war was really solely to make, you know, the private sector money. It was not to make war an easier or more stealth thing.
Well, remember, too, that after the first Gulf War, there was a round of downsizing of the United States military in an overall sense. And remember, too, that there were people back then, as there are now, who felt that the best way to downsize the military was, in fact, to lower through attrition the number of soldiers that you actually had in the various branches of the service. And that's where this whole idea that we can use weapons to win wars came from, was in the downsizing of the number of soldiers in each branch, then how are you going to conduct a war?
Well, it's sort of like in the economic sector, just in jobs in general. If you can make a machine that could replace, you know, 50 people, that would save your company a lot of money. But I was under the misassumption that by privatizing the war and you brought in these private sector mercenaries or contractors or whatever they were, that somehow that would be cutting costs, but really it doesn't. It just channels the taxpayers' money directly into the pockets of corporations, as opposed to, and I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, people are not, you know, more supportive or self-sacrificing in terms of the war, not only because they don't see that it's justified, number one, but number two, so many of the people involved are voluntary, and so many of them are corporate contractors that they don't feel a direct connection.
But don't forget, too, that this whole private sector thing is not just in the military. It's happening in terms of faith-based initiatives. It's happening in terms of health care. It's happening across the board. Bush is pushing government money into the private sector in all these different little areas.
Wow. That's absolutely true, Mark Riley. And we'll talk about it some more. And we'll be back with the liberal agenda and many other things. Sedition at AirAmericaRadio.com. If you didn't get your call through, thanks for calling us. We'll be back in a second on Air America Radio. Good morning. It's Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott here on Air America Radio. Next hour, we've got Thomas Friedman from the New York Times, who's going to be talking about outsourcing. That should be an interesting discussion. And guess how many negative ads George Bush and company have aired?
Loads.
You got a number?
No, but most of them, I would say.
49,050 negative ads nationwide, you know, since the beginning of this charade that we're calling a campaign.
I think
49,050?
We should have a second pause after that.
That's a lot of no. That's a lot of, he's bad. That's a lot of, like, you know, that guy. Could you stand up under that pressure? I get two negative emails, I crumble. 49,000.
That's a lot of lying.
Now, these are 49,000 spots. It's not 49,000 separate ads. It's, you know,
no, I know
the
that,
number of
I,
times.
That would
I know,
be
but we want to make sure the audience knows.
Like, with some person, was there actually someone out there going, wow, there's that many commercials? 49,050 different commercials? How could they ever think of that many things to say bad?
No wonder he's spending so much money on his campaign.
Of course that's where all the money goes. On the other side, Kerry, you know, has run 13,336 negatives. And that, not because there's not as much negative stuff to say about Bush, but he's got to count his pennies. Now, what I want to know, like, you know, As I said, I'm a relatively recently politically awakened person. And I don't remember, you know, campaigns of days past. I think the first campaign, my mother took me to hear McGovern speak in 1972.
Okay.
And I remember that she liked him a great deal. And of course, I was nine, so I was not able to really, you know, process it mentally what was going on. But aren't all campaigns negative? Was there a time in American politics where someone running for president would say, you know, the other guy who's running against me, I love him, great guy. I've had lunch with him, a lot of interesting things to say, but I think I'm a better guy.
All political campaigns have an element of negativity, and there's an ebb and flow in politics, and it depends in many instances now in 21st century America on whether polling is telling you that negative ads work. The fact is that people do negative ads because they feel they work. Now, you go back a century, you go back to the beginning of the 20th century, you'll find ads that are just as negative.
And slanderous? So was slander?
Slander was on the table, too. Remember that, for example, William Randolph Hearst, who was one of the biggest publishers, ran for president once.
Invented yellow journalism. Invented the journalism of slander.
It's not just that they work. It's the fact that the race is really close. I think that there are two things. That when polls show that negative ads will work, and when polls show, like as they do in this election, that it'll be decided primarily in a bunch of swing states where it's very, very close, that's when, and the candidate is looking very vulnerable on his two platforms, which was the war on terrorism and the economy, that's when they go negative big time.
Well, I mean, if you look at Hearst's ads, and remember that Hearst had newspapers to back him up. This is long before there was this kind of sophisticated polling.
Charles Foster Kane.
Yep. I mean, he went after people. He ran for the mayoralty of New York City. He ran for Congress. He won. He ran for governor of New York. He ran for everything.
And he won.
He lost more than he won.
Right. Here's the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound for today, Tuesday, day after Memorial Day. Get your pencils and notebooks. One, pressure baby name book authors to include the name Osama. Two, criticize new Iraqi president until he defends a woman's right to choose.
Oh, sure.
That's going to happen. Yeah. Three, thwart will of the people using activist judges. Four, find out where new Iraqi president stands on gay marriage, recycling, and funding for outsider art. Five, invite a renegade cleric to brunch. That's today's liberal agenda. Do what you will.
Eggs
with
Benedict
that.
With Babs. That'd be nice.
Absolutely.
In the next hour. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead, man. Lay it out.
Well, in the next hour of Morning's Edition, Mark Maron's dream diary. Thomas Friedman talks about outsourcing and, after a three-day weekend, Recovery Corner. Stay with us. This is Air America Radio.
Mark Maron here along with Sue Ellicott and Mark Riley on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Today, after a three-day weekend, George W. could use a visit to Recovery Corner. Plus, I'll share the contents of my dream diary, always a hit. And we've got a big, fat, big-time media exclusive today. Thomas Friedman from the New York Times is talking to us. But first,
I've got whoever.
Sue Ellicott, Mark Riley here.
Hey.
And Friedman's going to be talking about a new documentary about outsourcing. It's going to be very exciting and interesting. God, we're a little sluggish because it's
You better
Tuesday
wake up or your job will be outsourced to India, pal.
My driver this morning was from India. He was a Punjab. And is that a Punjab? Did I say that right? He is Punjabi.
Punjabi.
He'd been driving for about a week. I had to tell him how to go. And I told him
driving a week.
Yeah, he said he'd only been driving the car for a week. And I told him I was on the radio. And he goes, he says, my friend would like to buy a television. And I go, no, I'm on the radio. I'm on. He's okay. And then he goes.
He thought you were a salesman.
Yeah, he thought I was a radio salesman. And then he said, do you play any Indian music? I'm like, no, I don't. And then he started talking about XM, and I told him. Yeah, he said, my friend tells me of a. I just love doing Indian accent because it's the only accent I can do.
We have played Corner Shop a couple of times. That kind of counts.
Wait a minute. What about Jay-Z? With that, there's a Punjabi MC.
Well, he was all excited that he had heard that there's a radio that you can get for the car that only played Indian music. He had missed, he was. But it's so weird because it's difficult when people don't have See how good a control of the English language I have, but that he doesn't, and it's very. Sometimes it's like poetry, and you have to figure out exactly what they're getting at. But he wants to get XM so he can listen to any music. I was in Los Angeles all weekend, and it was the first time I'd been back since my beloved cat died. My little Butch had died, and I saw Butch's grave, and it was a weird thing because I have the living cat Boomer. I had a very ordinary people kind of weekend. You remember the movie that Robert Redford directed with Timothy Hutton and Donald Sutherland?
And Mary Tyler Moore, sure.
Where the one brother had died in some sort of boating accident, and the other one that was left was Mary Tyler Moore really grew to hate.
Yeah.
Because, he just represented the fact that the one she liked was dead. Well, I had this problem with my cat Boomer, who's a garbage cat. We got this cat. We went to the shelter, the pound, or whatever it is. Yeah. And we wanted a young cat, and all the cats that were there were these old, sort of thrown-away cats. But the one kitten that they had was completely skittish. We couldn't get it to get into the box. It hated people.
Feral.
Yeah. It really was. It was a completely feral cat. So we're like, that's ours. So now that's the only cat we have left, and it's completely skittish. Anytime you pick something up, like your pants, to put your pants on, it's like, ah! And it runs under the bed, anytime. Anytime you make a loud sound, it runs
falls
away.
Falls to pieces.
Yeah, and it eats too fast because it must have been starved when it was a kid. So it eats too fast and throws up right after it eats. So the cat is just a disaster. And now that's the cat that I have after my little princess cat died.
The one you really love.
So now I've got this spite, and I'm like, I walked in, and I'm like, why you? Why did you have to be the living cat?
It sounds
look at you snotty little thing.
Oh.
But I love.
Oh,
I mean,
that's what you get for being counterintuitive.
I don't even know what happened. Like when we first got the cat, it was to entertain the princess.
Uh-huh.
And then when we first brought Boomer into the house, the princess got sick. So I'm like, that cat's trying to kill Butch. So now I'm thinking maybe there was a protracted, long conspiracy, and maybe Boomer was responsible for Butch's demise. But I'm learning to love.
I think it's good that you're working all this stuff out on cats and you haven't got to the children thing yet, because that would be really
a little
terrible.
Bit, only slightly more complicated.
I can barely handle the cats.
I can hear that.
So outside of cats, there must be other things happening in the world.
There's a car bomb that exploded near the Green Zone again in northern Iraq.
That didn't
actually near the U.S. military base. Excuse me.
New one today?
Green Zone. This is.
There was one yesterday.
This is Tuesday. That would be today.
Yeah, so that's the second in 2 days.
Yeah, 11 Iraqis killed, 26 wounded, according to a source in the Interior Ministry. And that source came from the Associated Press. The blast occurred about 9 a.m., which is about 2 o'clock this morning Eastern time, outside the gates of the 1st Infantry Division's forward operating base in the town of Beji, which is 155 miles north of Baghdad. Press spokesman for the 1st Infantry could not confirm the number of casualties. But, yes, there has been yet another car bombing.
So that's
in Iraq.
That's like the fourth in about 2 weeks, right outside the green zone, which is supposed to be the kind of the safe haven where most of the foreigners are inside the great big compound.
Well, this one wasn't green zone.
It wasn't green zone.
No, this one was 155 miles north of Baghdad.
Oh, sorry.
But it was near the 1st Infantry, because I thought it was the green zone at first, too. But it's near the 1st Infantry Division's forward operating base, which means it's near a place that's supposed to be secure.
Right. It's also kind of interesting on the day when they finally named the president who will take over after June 30th, that I think when these attacks come right after something that is politically so insensitive and is being controversial, it reminds us how things really are not secure.
Yeah, it sounds like they're ready for that turnover or that handover.
Yeah.
Right?
You see, you didn't want to call it a turnover again.
It sounds like that Iraq is stabilized to the point where they're completely ready for the handover of power to a sovereign Iraq, except for the 135,000 troops.
Now, there was a car bomb explosion on Monday. That's the one.
There was. I heard about it, and I was on the way to the airport from London, and I thought, that's not good. That's the third in 2 weeks. Now this is the fourth. That's consecutive days.
So that would be really no good, right?
Yeah.
They're no good, are they? None of them are any good, Mark.
Now, remember the name, Ghazi Mashal Ajil al-Yawar. He is the president of Iraq, and I don't know if we'll hear his name again because it's largely a symbolic and ceremonial.
He might be out of a job tomorrow. He might buckle and say, you know what, I've rethought it. Yeah, because that's happened, twice?
Yeah, and I mean, there were explosions heard in central Baghdad as the appointment was announced. So, you know, you kind of get the feeling that not everybody was overjoyed.
Maybe we'll see what happens with this president.
Well, there's a lot of levels here. Remember that the Iraqi Governing Council, who had promoted Yawar against Paul Bremer's choice, and Paul Bremer, of course, is the U.S. administrator, he was in favor of Adnan Pachachi.
Pachachi, right, and then that was his guy, and then they all said, we don't want him. And he said, let me say it again. We would like Pachachi to be the guy. Yeah. They're like, no, we don't want him. Let me repeat myself. The United States would like Pachachi to be the president.
I mean, something must have gone on with the coalition that they appointed over the last few months, because this was the guy who was heading the current council. So I'm really curious to find out why it is that the Americans don't want him. What has gone on behind the scenes that has alienated Paul Bremer from this guy? I mean, he's done the job. He's sort of been almost in training. He's clearly got on with a big coalition of people. Why not go with that guy?
Well, didn't it seem like because he was so powerful in the tribal community and was head of one of the larger tribes?
Shamar, I believe. Yeah.
That would be a threat to what the U.S., I think, want to do there, which is kind of control it secretly?
Or it could be that, you know, he's a sheikh, Ghazi al-Yawar, they think that the religious element is too strong.
And he was critical. He was critical of the American.
Oh, that'll do it.
Absolutely. That's true. He did say that their running of Iraq since the end of the official end of the war had been inept. That doesn't go down too well with the Bush administration,
no.
Does it?
And, see, here's the other part. There's no guarantee that Yawar, despite the fact that he's popular with the governing council, don't mistake the governing council with the Iraqi people. The Americans have made that mistake before.
Well, that's why they didn't like Pachachi. I mean, that's why the Iraqis are like, who's this guy? He's been out of the country for 20 years.
Well, they may not want Yawar either.
Even Shalabi, you know, who was trying to grease all the wheels at the same time. The Iraqi people are like, that guy? You got to be kidding me.
Well, you know, that was one of the more interesting things that I heard about over the weekend. I think it was Saturday, that the same group of neocons who had promoted Shalabi in the first place were now trying to convince the Bush administration that they had acted too hastily in dumping him. In other words, they still want to push the guy.
Oh, that's crazy.
Of course it's crazy, but these neocons, I think they feel emboldened.
I think that guy was such a spineless operator that they thought he would really do our bidding in all levels, that, you know, he's got no character of his own. Still ahead, we're getting Thomas Friedman on the phone, which should be very exciting, so come back. We've got my dream diary, which will be exciting for some of you, and many more things here on Air America Radio. We're back. Vacation's over. It was short, but now summer vacation starts for a lot of the kids of the world. Right now, we got to do this quickly. My dream diary. This is last night I had the dream. today I bring it in, and on Thursday I bring them all to my therapist. So this is let me just see if I can make this out from last night, my dream diary. It's the last day of high school before summer, and I've got severe senioritis. I've got a wicked permed mullet and a fuzzy little baby half mustache. I'm wearing a black baseball jersey with white sleeves. I got a Thin Lizzy concert. I rock. A new pimple appears and erupts every hour like Old Faithful. So I'm watching the clock tick down to 3 and going completely nuts. I've covered my desk with graffiti. School sucks. Only I spelled it S-U-X. In five minutes, I'm going to be out cruising the boulevard in my El Camino, blasting the Sabbath, Fog at Molly Hatchet on the 8-track. But those last 5 minutes take like a year. The clock is mocking me. I'm being clock mocked. My face turns into a black light, and the blackboard becomes a poster with a panther and Bruce Lee. And then the alarm finally goes off, and it sounds like the beginning of Hell's Bells by AC/DC. Cool, I think. I start to run for the door when someone says, "Where do you think you're going, son?" It's Principal Rumsfeld, and he's got his hand on my shoulder. Damn. It's summer, Principal Rumsfeld. All my friends are waiting for me. I point to the parking lot, and there's Alice Cooper and Ozzy and Ted Nugent roasting a llama, and Angus Young in a schoolboy outfit, and Gene Simmons, who's breathing fire and squeezing two Playboy bunnies. I don't care who's waiting for you, Marin. You're going to stay in Iraq another 6 months. You're going to clean all the ink off this desk and every desk in school, and sucks is spelled S-U-C-K-S, you idiot. I say, okay, I'll go to Iraq, but only if I can be in the KISS Army. And suddenly, I'm in Iraq, and my face is painted like Peter Criss, the cat. And I'm trying to deflect bullets with my 8-inch silver platform heels, and I'm thinking, well, at least I'm not in summer school. I woke up, and my bed was filled with naga hide. Made out of naga hide, perhaps. Wow, what is that all about, that dream? Some people are like, oh, the dream diary. What a nice lyrical poem that was. Other people are like, I hate this guy, and this dream diary is BS. Can I? Yes. Our first guest is a columnist with the New York Times. He's got a documentary coming up on the Discovery Channel called The Other Side of Outsourcing. He also is pretty proficient in talking about a lot of things. Today, Thomas Friedman is with us. Thomas Friedman, are you there?
I'm here.
How are you, sir?
Great. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I want to talk a little about a bit about Iraq first and then move into the outsourcing
whatever
topic.
You like.
What do you think needs to happen now? What does the administration need to do in Iraq as of today?
Well, they've just announced this morning in Baghdad the completion of the caretaker government that's supposed to rule over Iraq until elections can be held, both for a kind of constituent constitution assembly and then for a new permanent Iraqi government.
Is it going to hold this
Hard to tell. It's given the range of options that were available in Iraq, this is not, I would say, an awful government. I think there's some decent people in there, people with reasonable amounts of legitimacy. And we'll really just have to see. I hate to be so indecisive, but basically there are two big questions out there. How will this government behave with what kind of coherence and efficiency if and when they're actually handed the keys? And how will the Iraqi people respond to them? Will they see them as more legitimate than the governing council? A lot of these guys were on the governing council. Will they not? And I think it's just too soon to tell. We're going to have to let this play out a little bit.
Why were they, do you think, so the Iraqi people so anti-Pachachi?
Well, yeah, Adnan Pachachi was a former foreign minister of Iraq. And I don't think the Iraqi people actually had any voice in this whatsoever. It was the members of the governing council who were resisting the appointment of Pachachi by Bremer and Brahimi, the UN representative and our representative. And I think it had to do with the fact that Pachachi was seen as too pro-American, and they wanted someone with more of an independent background, and that's Ghazi Awar, the man who ultimately was appointed president.
Thomas Friedman, where is Ali al-Sistani, the leading Shiite cleric and apparently the most popular cleric in Iraq? Where do you think he is on all of this?
As far as I understand from my own reporting, he has very much backed the appointment of Iyad Alawi, the Shiite former exile who has been appointed prime minister. And so when Sistani doesn't like how things are going, he tells us or finds a way to tell us, and he clearly has backed Alawi. Alawi has pretty good relations with him, as I understand.
Thomas Friedman, in your reporting on the Middle East and on Iraq for the New York Times, what does the appointment of the new government tell us, or what will the administration do from here on in about the rest of the Middle East? We've heard about, you know, Iraq being the sort of, you know, the sort of landing stage for the democratization of the region. What chance is there of that?
Well, you know, I can't really speak for and wouldn't want to speak for the administration. All I can tell you my own view is that you know, what the best outcome in Iraq, to me, the best way to think about it is to think about the former Soviet Union. I've always thought of the former Soviet Union as a country that was very much the former Soviet Empire, including Eastern Europe, is a country that was tilted in the wrong direction and tilted against any possibility of its own people really, you know, being able to express themselves and achieve their full potential. I think what we're trying to do, and Iraq under Saddam Hussein, one would say, was also tilted in the wrong direction. I think the most we can expect from Iraq in the coming years is that with this new government and that they slowly work their way to elections, you'll get a country that's tilted in the right direction. It'll only be tilted, but that's really important. By tilted in the right direction, I mean like Putin's Russia today, which is hardly a Jeffersonian democracy, but it is a country where there's a heck of a lot more free speech, a heck of a lot more rule of law, a heck of a lot more opportunity for young people to plan their future and fulfill their potential. And if we can get that in Iraq, you know, I think that will be a net positive thing, not only, of course, for Iraqis, but generally for the region as a whole. If we end up with Afghanistan on steroids, obviously that will be a whole other question. So you got to hope for the best. But if Iraq is tilted in the right direction, that will be a good thing.
How positive do you feel about the direction?
I hate to be – I'm not deliberately trying to be coy. It's really too soon to tell. We just don't know until we see how coherent this government is, how good it is at, you know, all politics is local. How good is it revving up the Iraqi economy and getting jobs, you know, into the hands and houses of the Iraqi people and bringing a sort of reasonable level of stability? If you get that, that's a lot, but I think it's just too soon to tell.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas Friedman, why was there such an explosion of acrimony over what is largely a ceremonial choice of president? Why would there be such a beef between Bremer and the governing council over that and not over the prime minister?
Sure. Well, first of all, there was obviously, for whatever reason, more consensus over the prime minister, but even that wasn't a slam dunk. But I think it's because people understand that, you know, given the kind of chaotic situation in Iraq, this government could actually end up being there for a long time. That's number one. Yes, they're supposed to hold elections, you know, within roughly the next year, but that could easily slip. And so what looks like a ceremonial position today could congeal into something else. And secondly, you know, this is about a struggle for power. And, you know, once power is on the table and available for the first time to the Iraqi people, there are going to be forces who are going to grab and tug for a slice, even if it looks to be ceremonial. So, actually, I think it's a good sign. I mean, you would you know, think about it for a sec. You know, given all the violence that's happened in Iraq in the last, you know, year, would you be rushing and clawing and grabbing to be the next president of Iraq, knowing that your predecessor was blown up in a suicide bomb? And so I think it's not only rather brave of these people, but it's a good sign to me that they want to be part of this process.
And what about negotiating with people like al-Sadr? How does that play out with the people quickly?
Well, yeah, it's an important question, and I think that what you're going to see now is the reason al-Sadr has been sort of slowly inching his way, you know, down the tree that he's put himself in, is that the United States is technically going to be handing over sovereignty in Iraq in 30 days. Now, we'll see exactly what that means, and I can't tell you myself. But basically, now that there's an Iraqi government formed, it's going to be less and less every day Sadr against Bremer, Sadr against the U.S. coalition. It's going to be Sadr against the self-ruling authority of the Iraqi people. Mm-hmm. And even if they aren't fully sovereign, nevertheless, these people, once they are in charge, are going to want to be more and more sovereign every day. So Sadr is going to be, he is, as of today, Sadr is a fundamental threat to Ghazi Yawar. And I have a feeling that Iraqis, this new Iraqi government, will find a way, one way or another, to deal with him, because he is a threat to them now.
Thomas Friedman is with us. He's from the New York Times. He's staying with us, so stay tuned as we discuss outsourcing. Plus, we've got the presidential daily briefing on tap and Recovery Corner in the next half hour here on Air America Radio.
Welcome back, or good morning. I'm Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott on Air America Radio. Our guest is New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman. He has a documentary, The Other Side of Outsourcing, premiering on the Discovery Channel on Thursday, June 3rd, from 10 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time. Thomas, do you what is outsourcing a good thing or a bad thing for America? This is a very hot issue.
I think it's a good net. It's a good thing because what outsourcing does is basically allow American companies, among many others, to speed and lower the cost of innovation. And what is going to keep our country and its standard of living rising the way it's been is our continued ability to innovate. And the fact that we can now connect up all the best knowledge pools in the world and kind of access those for our own companies and our own ideas, that's a good thing.
Well, I guess the question then is, you know, why can't we do that here? How do you speak to the, you know, literally thousands of people that feel that outsourcing is denying them of their jobs? Why can't this innovation take place in America?
Yeah, well, part of it has to do with literally sheer shortages of certain careers that we need, like engineers, for instance. You know, wireless engineers are probably the, you know, one of the most sought. If your son or daughter is interested in getting scooped up in a career, please advise him or her to be a wireless engineer. So a lot of it has to do with simply sheer technical sources of people. Some of it has to do with labor rates, absolutely. Go ahead.
I was just saying, is this an indication that perhaps maybe the educational system or people aren't learning these trades, or that they're not focused properly, that we don't have this workforce?
I just did a graduation ceremony at a college in the Midwest. I was the commencement speaker, and people were asked to stand up by class as they got their degrees. And I was really struck, you know, when they called on the arts and science students, you know, it looked to me like about two-thirds of the student body, you know, stood up. And when they called on the engineering students, you know, it looked like, I'm not going to say a handful, but a much, much smaller slice stood up. And that's really kind of the situation we're in. Don't hold me to these exact statistics. But
a handful?
I'm not going to give you other statistics.
Right.
In China today, roughly 70% of all college grads are either in engineering or in the sciences. In India, it's about 60%. In America, it's a roughly 20%. Now, you keep doing that year over year, and you're simply not going to have the numbers you need to fill the jobs we need to continue to have an innovating society.
That's really interesting. So maybe you know, college students should sort of maybe reprioritize or not think about partying so much.
Yeah, well, also it would be nice if we had a president who, an administration that used the bully pulpit of the presidency to stress these issues of competitiveness, because they're really going to become important over time. China wants to eat your lunch, you know, and so does India. And as we move into, you know, what I like to call an increasingly flat world where the playing field is leveled, and everyone through kind of this wiring of the world is able to play in the game at the same time, your kids and mine are going to be competing head-to-head with young kids from China and India. I interviewed Craig Barrett, the head of Intel, and again, I'm sorry, none of these statistics at my fingertips, but you know, the number of American kids taking part in the Intel Science Contest, which is really the premier science contest for high school kids, was about one-tenth the number taking part in it in China, and even accounting for disparities, maybe it was 1/20, whatever, but it was a tiny fraction compared to how many kids in China were taking part.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas Friedman, give us a sense, if you will, from your reporting and your writing at the New York Times about that issue, China wants to eat your lunch. What can the Bush administration do, or what can the U.S. government do in terms of student loans or incentives to try specifically to get young people go into sciences and engineering?
Well, I think you really touched on it. I think it's a couple things. One, sheer incentives in the form of, you know, scholarships and things of that nature. And the other is, as I say, use the bully pulpit of the presidency to make young people more aware of these careers and how important they're going to be for the future economic health of our country. You know, if you don't have these people if we aren't doing the kind of hard, basic research. It's also using the government's resources to fund engineering research and basic science research at universities all over the country, because so much of that drives innovation. I mean, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, the two guys who founded Google, Google's based on a mathematical algorithm. And they were basically math students at Stanford, doing really hard basic research that on the surface no one ever thought would turn into the most proficient and efficient and popular search engine in the world, and is now going to be a huge IPO, spinning off incredible number of jobs for Americans, and probably outsourced jobs also to other people around the world. I just got a statement this morning from Hewlett-Packard announcing that the Bank of India, which is the biggest bank of India, has just awarded a huge outsourcing contract to HP. So India, this isn't all one way. India, looking for the most efficient, company to help it run its back room, has now turned to an American company, which is partnered also with an Indian company, to do the outsourcing for the Bank of India. This is going to be, the idea that only jobs are going from America to Indians is really fatuous nonsense. What's going around is coming around, and the most efficient, producers are going to be the ones who will win.
So I still don't, in the big picture, though, unless American, students start refocusing their energies, or unless, if we don't, if we fundamentally don't have the skills to do this, I don't see how outsourcing is really going to help us.
Well, I'll tell you, nothing's going to help us if we don't produce new generations of people with the skills, energy, and aspirations to innovate. Because what makes your economy grow and become more productive, which is the source, which is how standards of living rise, is innovation. And America's great advantage has always been, as a society, as a culture, and as a system, its ability to innovate. And nothing's going to help you if you aren't producing people who can do that.
Thomas Friedman, a quick two-part question. One, didn't Bill Gates offer some incentives in the form of scholarships to students who took up sciences and engineering? And number two, do not large numbers of Asian immigrants, whether from Asia, China, India, wherever, don't large numbers of their children go into the sciences and engineering here?
I think that's the case, but I don't have the statistics at my fingertips to prove it. But, I certainly, as I recall, if you go to sort of the average engineering school in America, first of all, there's just an enormously high percentage of foreign students studying in all of our engineering schools, because we still, really excel in higher education. That's one thing we haven't lost. But if you look at engineering schools around America, something on the order of 40% of their students are actually foreign students coming over here because we don't have the space, and we're, of course, educating them. Now, the good news in that is a lot of them are also staying. A significant portion of the new companies founded in Silicon Valley every year are founded by foreigners. Now, if you really look at outsourcing, what you see is that you may have the innovators in Silicon Valley. So what you'll have in America are the president of the company, the vice president, the head of engineering, probably the chief technical officer, and all the sales and marketing people. Because America is where the customers still are primarily. Mm-hmm. It's where the first users are. So you actually have the whole kind of management team here. And, of course, if you look at any company, which are the highest-paying jobs? They tend to be on the management side.
Can we finish up the answer,
sure,
right when you come back? I remember where you are. And we're going to take some calls from 866-303-2270, 866-303-AAR0. Call us with questions for Thomas Friedman, and we're going to finish up his answer about management right here on Air America Radio. Five past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. I'm with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott. We are talking to Tom Friedman, whose documentary, The Other Side of Outsourcing, premieres on the Discovery Channel on Thursday, June 3rd, from 10 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time. The presidential daily briefing is usually done now. We are going to push that off to the next segment because we have a very informative guest who I interrupted previous to this last break and would like him to, Thomas, could you finish that thing you were saying about management being the highest paid?
If you look at American firms that are outsourcing, that maybe are doing it right from the beginning, right from the get-go, you know, is that they tend to have the senior management here, and they're outsourcing a lot of the technical skills to, let's say, a place called like Bangalore, India, and taking advantage of the lower wages there for engineers. But basically what that means is that the highest-paying jobs, which tend to be the management jobs, are staying in America, and they're taking advantage of outsourcing basically to speed their ability to innovate and to bring cheaper products to market and to become more competitive. Now, that isn't only important for what they produce here for the American market, but you have countries like India and China now opening up to the world in terms of their middle class as markets. I mean, just take a simple thing like cell phone technology. Well, you know, the average, you know, American may, you know, spend $40 a month. These are just made up numbers, you know, on cell phone use. The average Indian or Chinese middle class person maybe can only afford, you know, $8 to $10. Well, the trick in succeeding if you're selling that technology is be able to come up with technology that can be profitable at the $8 or $10 level. That often requires outsourcing, but if you do it, you can really drive not only innovation, but obviously make a more profitable American company as well.
Well, I understand what you're saying, and we've got a lot of calls here. I mean, people are very excited to talk about this issue. Like, I have an email right in front of me that says, outsourcing engineering jobs drives the salaries down and discourages students from choosing engineering as a career.
You know, that may be, but you'd have to prove that. That tends to be more anecdotal. I mean, last time I checked, you know, just looking at the statistics, you know, we've never done more outsourcing in our country's history than we're doing right now.
So you're saying we don't know if that's
true. And jobs are growing in this country at the moment. So, I mean, somebody's got to explain the math to me. I can't do it, but all I know is anecdotally, you know, jobs are growing. And at the same time, we're doing more outsourcing than ever. So maybe what's really happening is, you know, more and more companies are innovating and doing these things, and jobs are growing both here and there.
Okay, we're talking to Thomas Friedman of the New York Times. Bill in Brooklyn, do you have a question for Thomas?
Well, I'm not so sure it's a question. I have a disagreement. I think outsourcing is forever. I think that we're never going to recover our the prosperity we had 10, 20, 30 years ago. We're not top dogs anymore. The internet has leveled the playing field. It's no longer country to country. It's person to person. And we're 10 years away from the United States of the world, in which the United States is just one state in the United States of the world. Oh, 7 out of 10 American 17-year-olds are unable to read English proficiently.
Okay, all right, thank you, Bill. Let's see. Let's have Thomas address that. Thomas?
Well, I think, you know, Bill raises a very good point, that we got a little fat and lazy, frankly, after the end of the Cold War. We stood astride the world as the world's only superpower. We seem to be unrivaled economically and militarily, to be sure. But I think what we didn't pay attention to is what, you know, my next book is about. I'm actually going on sabbatical to write, which is about the leveling of this playing field, the flattening of the world, as I like to call it. Mm-hmm. And more and more people who are really well-educated or getting there are coming into the playing field, able to compete directly with Americans for jobs, and either we get our game up and improve and meet this challenge, or as Bill said, the standard of living that we knew growing up, you know, will not be. It's a more wide open game now.
Huh. Matt, you have a question for Thomas Friedman, Matt?
Good morning, Mr. Friedman. I've been listening to your comments, and I can't help but disagree with you on a couple of different points.
Sure.
Number one. While I agree that we do need to outsource and that we are part of a global economy now, even still, we cannot produce a whole nation of people with a math and science background. We still, and my degree is in industrial labor relations.
Uh-huh.
We still need to have the common working folk. And what people are so upset about with the outsourcing of these jobs is that middle class America is beginning to dwindle.
Okay, thanks a lot, Brian. We don't have time for the whole question, but I think that he can address that. Thomas?
Yeah, I think that's very true, and I personally take it very seriously. As an individual, I would like my tax dollars to be used in part to helping people caught in that bind. But let's not forget that, you know, at the turn of the century, what, 30% of the American economy or more was involved in agriculture.
Right.
That all those people lost their jobs, too. But they found a way to do it. And one of the cures at the time was to make secondary education mandatory. We may have to go into an era where we make tertiary education, that's higher education, college, technical college, mandatory, and have the government support people to do that. That is the only answer.
Thank you very much for joining us, Thomas Friedman. The Other Side of Outsourcing premieres on the Discovery Channel at on June 3rd, Thursday, from 10 to 11 p.m. It was tremendous having him here today to talk about that stuff. We will be back with the Recovery Corner and the PDB, I guess. So a lot of comedy in the next segment. So stay here on Air America Radio. We're back. You're listening to Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. With Mark Riley, Sue Ellicott. I am Mark Maron, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Mark.
In Recovery Corner, I reach out to fellow 12-steppers who are struggling to stay clean and sober. Today, I'm offering my help to my sponsee, George W., as always. Hey, listen, George, it was a long weekend. Didn't hear from you, buddy. Thought you might have, you know, done the thing we're not supposed to do, you know what I'm saying? Hey, look, I understand you had to spend Memorial Day dedicating the World War II monument, having to stand and smile while you listen to some 80-year-old geezer rambling on about storming Omaha Beach. I mean, that's enough to drive anybody back to the bottle. Plus, temptation is everywhere. At the barbecue, there's that cooler full of St. Pauli girl. And, yeah, I know the Secret Service's orders to keep Jenna and Barb away from it, but the only person who can keep you away from it is you, George W. Now, I'm not saying that you did, but... if you need to start your day count over, that's okay. No judgment. None of us are perfect. There's nothing a good fourth and fifth step can't fix. After you work the first three, of course. It's a marathon, not a sprint, my friend. Unlike handing over power to the Iraqis, there's no self-imposed deadline. Okay? It's one day at a time. Remember, nothing is so bad that a drink will make it worse. Think. There's no chemical solution to a spiritual problem. Bend your knee before you bend your elbow. That's it. You know, I mean, don't drink and get to a meeting. Okay. I hope you're okay. We just, you haven't touched base and we're all concerned. So now we got some emails. I mean, Thomas Friedman is certainly.
Woo.
Sorry. I didn't mean to do that.
People seem to have a pretty,
I laid my emails on top of the evil machine.
That's one heavy email.
Yeah. I don't even know which one that was.
Well, this is one I have here. Outsourced news reporting, I'm sick of Friedman. Now, unfortunately, Thomas Friedman of the New York Times is not here to defend himself, but I think that sort of really typifies many people's reaction when they hear Thomas Friedman and others take the view that outsourcing ultimately strengthens America. People find that hard to hear, and they're not sure if they believe it.
Well, it's Americans have a hard time. I think we all do. You know, I mean, I think there's a denial in terms of, like, you know, we have the myth of America being the best, always the best.
Well, here's another denial, I guess. Thomas Friedman should take his head out of his ass. No, Thomas Friedman should take his head out of ass. Maybe the Indian guy who took my job can write an op-ed piece for 1/100th the price of this a-hole Friedman.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Nothing like tax.
Sorry, Tom.
Yeah, really.
I'm going to watch the documentary and, you know, and try to understand a little broader, you know, what is really going on, because it is something that a lot of people are upset about. And there's a lot of people, not me per se, who have lost jobs with this stuff, who have a very different, very personal reaction to it.
True.
Right now it's time for the presidential daily briefing. This is the top secret intelligence document that comes from Department of Homeland Security. Today's PDB, Your Father Must Die. Mr. President, it's come to our attention that former President George H.W. Bush said the following to Time magazine. Quote, the country is doing pretty darn well, but the war in Iraq is a large problem. There's a lot of what Jimmy Carter called malaise around. In our estimation, Bush Sr. just made four serious mistakes. One, he spoke to Time magazine. Two, he mentioned Jimmy Carter, a weak one-term president. Three, he said that your glorious war in Iraq was a problem. And four, he used the word malaise, which in addition to having negative overtones, is clearly French. It seems that the ex-president has become a loose cannon. It's time to think about taking him out. Now, we're aware of your special relationship with the former president, but consider the larger picture. The elimination of your father dovetails nicely with Mr. Rove's re-election strategy. It could eliminate dissenting voices while at the same time create a massive sympathy vote that would be difficult for Kerry campaigns to stop. I can't breathe in.
Hey, I'm Mark Maron with Stu Ellicott and Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 minutes past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Pulling it together the day after a vacation. We'll check out the president's Palm Pilot for today. Plus, we'll tell you what all you good liberals are supposed to do now that you're over the guilt of not going to any Memorial Day parades. And we'll have Tammy Faye Starlight in-house in the studio singing a couple of her songs. That's all coming up right now. I'm joined by Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott. Good morning.
Good day.
Good morning.
Back from England, back from New Jersey.
Back from picnics.
from Los Angeles.
It was the summer holiday, day off, three-day weekend in England, too. Mm-hmm. So lots of picnics, not barbecues.
What's your excuse over there? Is it Memorial Day as well?
No, it is not. It's just that we don't need an excuse. We're very good at not working.
They got Cadbury. They don't need an excuse for anything.
She brought back all this British chocolate, so now I'm all jammed on chocolate.
Now, you know what? When my wife hears this, she's going to go crazy.
Take her some. Take her some of the whole milk.
No, she's not getting anything.
Oh, come on, you meanie. You guys.
Sorry, hon.
What? There's a whole other one there with nuts in it and everything.
I know, but. Well, maybe I will. I don't know. All I know is the Cadbury chocolate is heaven. It really is. It's unusually good chocolate.
It's amazing. It's amazing. It's a real buzz. I used to, like, when I was in England briefly for 2 weeks years ago when I was in high school, I'd have for breakfast just one of the little Cadbury bars, two cigarettes, mm-hmm. and a coffee, and I'd be jammed for 6 hours.
6 hours, right?
Right.
So now I want to address something that, you know, I got some bad email last week when I went to go see, what was it, a week before last week or a week before? I don't remember when it was, but I saw a press screening of The Day After Tomorrow, and I came on this station on this show and talked about it relatively in depth, though I did not really give away the ending because there wasn't an ending to give away, really, other than, like, basically it's like, well, what are you going to do? Hope we're going to be okay. It's awfully snowy now. You know, so now the movie is out, and I just want to address the people that went ahead and paid the money after hearing what I had to say about it. And I hope you realize that, you know, that everything that you thought you were going to get, you got in The Coming Attraction, number one. Number two, it was a bad movie, real crap. And you know, and if you really look at it, it had nothing to do with, like, environmental projections of the worst-case scenario. It had everything to do with it was just a little story about a father and his son set across the, you know, annihilation of most of the population of the planet. Had no ending. The movie had no ending other than the kid going, I knew my dad would come. Great. 80 billion people are dead. Who cares? So what happens? What are you, like, the next Adam and Eve there? It was ridiculous. And anybody who criticized me for criticizing that movie, we had one guy, because we interviewed the producer. Some guy wrote us an email that said, hey, what's with Maron giving a hard time to the producer? The guy's a good guy. He makes big movies so he can do crappy little ones as well. You know what? The hell with you, too. Being judgmental of me, you know, being critical of a Hollywood producer that wants nothing more than to separate you from your hard-earned, what is it, $8 to $12, whatever you paid to see the Hollywood sign rip away in a tornado, the only good part of the movie. And, what else am I saying?
Do you think that Cadbury should have a disclaimer on its chocolate bar?
For what?
For the kind of, like, sugared
we'll
chocolate.
Will cause ranting.
Outbursts. Yes, exactly. May cause venting.
No, but I mean, the thing is like, if you want it, like, I'm watching the news. It's almost impossible with the number of tornadoes that happened over the last 3 days to decide between the movie and the news. And that's just real life there. And they're not as great. Well, now all of a sudden I'm turning my. They're not as good as the ones that were in the movie, the Twisters. Maybe I'm wrong about it. You know, it's really kind of cool to see the disasters unfold in the movie. It's a bad movie. Anyways, let's talk about real disasters. Let's talk about the end of the world as it is unfolding, Mark Riley.
Well, I don't know whether it's the end of the world over in Iraq or not. I know there's a lot of stuff going on, including, and Sue, I don't know whether you have a sixth sense about this or what. But there was, in fact, a car bomb that exploded in central Baghdad, as you said last hour, and it ended up killing three people, injuring 20. This is in addition to the car bomb blast that we did discuss last hour, which took place in Beji, which is about 155 miles north of Baghdad.
But this is a new one? This is a third one? I mean, this is like different than like the one we talked about an hour ago?
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
So there's a car blowing up every hour
this one,
Iraq right now?
Just about. This one took it exploded outside the offices of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. Now, we haven't heard a lot about the Kurds. We haven't heard much from the Kurds of late. Of course, for those of you who don't know, the Kurdish region of Iraq, which they want to turn into their own sovereign state called Kurdistan, is in the northern part of the country. Some very brief history. The Kurds were encouraged by the United States to try and defeat Saddam in the immediate aftermath of Gulf War I. They tried to revolt. The U.S. kind of caught them up short, and many Kurds lost their lives as a direct result of what they saw at the time as the U.S. not really having their back in the wake of the first Gulf War.
Now, in this aftermath of this war, the Kurds in the north, as you say, have actually been has been one of the most stable parts of the country, with none of the violence that we've seen in Najaf, Fallujah, around Baghdad, other areas, and also the most economically successful. The Kurds have had a much better time and been more effective in a business sense and in kind of getting their lives together than anywhere else. And interestingly, with the appointment today of the new president, they also seem to be happy about him.
Well, what is this? So what do you see this as? It seems that these bombs are well placed. They're there for a reason. Who do you think is trying to intimidate the governing council, these choices? I mean, clearly it's a reaction to the new president,
to the new
prime minister,
actually to the naming of what appears now to be an entire cabinet. There are obviously people who have a problem with this kind of transition taking place because they feel that the Americans, no matter what happens and no matter who's appointed, are behind everything. The Americans are still left as occupiers in the wake of all of this. And they don't want to see that happen. And, of course, there are people who are still loyal to Saddam Hussein who also are involved in this insurgency. There are allegations that there are al-Qaeda people who are also who have made common cause. The troubling or the interesting thing about the Kurds, I think, is the question of whether or not the United States will promote a Kurdish nation in the wake of very, very strong opposition from Turkey, which has historically been the reason why the United States has not backed any Kurdish move towards sovereignty. The Turks kind of irritated the U.S. Remember back when the Gulf War, when this latest Iraq war began, the Turks at first said they would allow the United States to U.S. forces to use their soil as a base, and then they retracted it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know whether now the Americans are as into accommodating the Turks on Kurdistan as they might have been 2 years ago.
God, is there anything that isn't in the mix as far as trying to figure out how this is going to play itself out politically?
Hey,
I mean,
that's why we're having all the bombs now, because there's so many disgruntled people, and the sense of kind of insecurity is so great.
And on top of that, now it's like because of the instability, you know, as it said in the International Institute of Strategic Studies, you know, the report that came out a week and a half ago that, you know, that the Iraq conflict has arguably focused the energies and resources of al-Qaeda and its followers while diluting those of the global counterterrorism coalition that appeared so formidable. That on top of the chaos that is just coming from within Iraq, it's now attracting, you know, terrorist activities from everywhere else.
Yeah.
And terrorist fighters, I guess you would call them, into Iraq.
Now, we got a couple of minutes left. I don't want to forget a very important story that moved, I believe is moving this week. I think it's in Newsday, around the question of whether or not the Pentagon is still covering up additional allegations of abuse at Abu Ghraib, number one. And number two, the question of whether American soldiers on routine patrols, now this has been alleged, not proven, but alleged, whether they have been looting places, the homes of ordinary Iraqis,
assaulting, jewelry.
These are some very, very serious allegations. Now, the Pentagon supposedly has 30-some-odd investigations going on in the wake of Abu Ghraib. If they are simultaneously covering up while they're investigating, it would seem to me that none of those investigations are going to mean anything when they're done. But beyond that, you know, the question of whether or not Americans are actually pillaging during these routine patrols, which is interesting because the al-Sadr people, the people that the Shiites that are loyal to Muqtada al-Sadr, have said that they felt that American soldiers should be less aggressive in their patrolling of their region.
But it's interesting, you mentioned pillaging, which is clearly how it's seen from the Iraqi people's side. I think it also plays into the sort of taking things to extremes from the U.S. by the U.S. forces of assuming that everybody is guilty until proven innocent, because much of this money and jewelry was apparently taken with the rationale that these were all items of value that could be used to fund insurgency. And so things that were seen as possibly able to, that people could sell and use to plow into insurgent groups, they were taken, and they were supposed to give receipts, but that didn't always happen. But people have jewelry. They carry money on them. These are not people who have banks. There's no reason to assume it's all about funding insurgencies.
But wasn't there also, like, at the beginning of the conflict, there was a lot of looting that was allowed to happen of museums, of art pieces, of, you know, a lot of that stuff got, you know, put into the international market that was sort of allowed.
That was dealt with, and military members were punished for that.
So then maybe this will be another investigation or something.
But I mean, the central
question, another investigation.
Yes, but this is a central question here. If the Pentagon is in fact covering up, what good are their investigations?
Exactly. Someone's got to take the hit eventually. Maybe Rumsfeld will go down. Still ahead, the president's Palm Pilot, and we'll tell you who's not getting communion now, right here on Air America Radio. We're back. Little Buffalo Tom. I wish those guys had made it. I'm Mark Maron. This is Morning Sedition. I'm here with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott on Air America Radio. We're talking about the day after tomorrow briefly. Roland Emmerich, who did Independence Day, at least in Independence Day, the ugly Quaid brother saved the world by sacrificing himself. In the new movie, the good-looking Quaid brother could do nothing but reestablish his bond with his son and say, well, I guess we'll be okay. We'll just learn how to build a little ice house or something. Right now it's time for my guy who works in the Oval Office, downloaded the presidential Palm Pilot for this morning. Here's the president's schedule. 8 a.m., wake up, take Memorial Day flag bunting off presidential bed. 9:30 a.m., review blueprints for World War III monument. Noon, choose new Iraqi president, inform next of kin. That's been done. 2 p.m. Choose another Iraqi president in case the other one doesn't last. Tell no one until June 30th, except Price Waterhouse. 4:30 p.m. Stop using phrase approval ratings. Start using phrase pity index.
Oh, dear.
6 p.m. Did Sue just say, oh, dear? That's wild.
It's a Cadbury.
Sometimes she laughs. Rarely she laughs. But now we just got her verbalizing. That's good. Oh, dear. We got no dear. 6 p.m., 3 days until Harry Potter movie opens. Note, tell press you enjoyed the prep school stuff, but tell Ashcroft you disapproved of all the witchcraft. 8 p.m., threatening call to Syria, just for fun. 9 p.m., video golf. Devise exit strategy for sand trap. 9:30, lights out. Note, first day of summer vacation, way too hard. You know what just happened in the middle of my reading that?
No.
From all the Cadbury and from the caffeination?
Uh-oh.
You ever had those moments when you're doing something and you don't have any idea where you are or what you're doing?
Probably.
It just happened. All of a sudden, I was just in a word. You know, all of a sudden, like, I realized my entire being was just in a word. And it was kind of frightening because I had no idea who you people were or why the microphone was here or what purpose I serve.
I guess if you're in a word, you want to be in a multi-syllabic one, don't you? Because it would be a better experience.
Something happened. It was weird. Maybe it's the NutraSweet. Maybe I know my mother's collapsing into some sort of NutraSweet-induced dementia. Maybe I'm starting. There's too much sweet and low in my brain and sugar.
Oh, I don't know.
Because I don't. This is going on too long, isn't it? I don't have sugar in my coffee, but I have sweet and low in my coffee. But all the sugar on top of this. That's it, man. It's the sugar and the sweet and low. That's what's going on, man. It's the unknown buzz. It'll tear apart any semblance of reality.
He's a human version of the day after tomorrow. He's going to start freezing over.
There are tornadoes going on inside of me.
Uh-oh.
There's an ice age in my colon.
Oh, Lord.
Don't worry, you'll be saved by the ugly Quaid brother.
Somebody call your proctologist.
I hope the ugly Quaid, as I referred to him, look at her dismissing from any responsibility. As you said the bad thing about the man, I, of course.
He's not that ugly, poor guy. I feel a bit sorry for him. He's not as good looking as his brother, that's true.
There you go. That was the point I was trying to make. So onward into homosexuality. Can we all go?
Yes. Onward and upward into homosexuality.
So gay supporters were denied communion at a Chicago Mass, and they weren't necessarily gay. They were just wearing
They were supporters of homosexuality.
They were wearing those gay rainbow sashes.
Yeah.
And I mean that, you know, both ways, and the word gay can be used.
Oh, see, now you know.
So now they're refusing communion to people who just support gays' rights to take Mass.
That's kind of that's a new step. It's a new step for them. It's not just
a new low, not
just judging people's sexual behavior, but now they're judging the people who support and are friends or with people who are gay, which seems to be a little over the top. Yes?
I don't know if that's the new low, because in Minnesota, it wasn't even the priest that refused to give communion. It was parishioners trying to block people wearing the sashes from going to get communion.
Okay, a new twist then. But what I don't understand is when this stuff happens, why people don't just, like people wearing the sashes, don't just say, you know what, we want our church to be tolerant. It's not. We're going elsewhere. I mean, if it gets this bad that people can't even display a support of someone whose behavior they might not even want to do themselves.
We're taking our God somewhere else.
Well, no, just stop. Just stop showing up at church. I mean, you basically vote with your feet, don't you? You stop showing up. You stop paying the money into the I can't remember the name of it, the tray that gets passed around.
Yeah, the offering plate.
Offering plate.
Well,
I have no idea. We didn't have that.
No, but you make a good point, and a lot of people apparently are voting with their feet. That's part of the reason why all of these all these archdioceses are closing so many parishes and closing down so many churches, because people have stopped going.
Well, also because they are going bankrupt from settling out of the lawsuits against the gay the pedophile priests. But the thing that our producer suggested, it might be an interesting idea, is that, you know, if everybody showed up, it's a slippery slope. If you start saying, well, do you have a gay family member? You can't have communion. If you have, if everyone should show up with a rainbow sash. Everyone should show up and then see if they deny everybody communion.
Well, I don't have to worry about that, because in my Episcopalian church, they offer communion to everyone.
That was the same at the church that I used to go to. And in the end, that's what people will do. People will, if they want to be open-minded and tolerant, they will shift to a church where the church leaders are open-minded and tolerant. If people feel that their church is not accommodating to kind of modern life and changes of attitudes, then they won't stay. There's room for an incredible breadth of political thought inside churches.
In my synagogue, no one was denied communion, which was weird.
Well, did you all have communion?
Yeah, oh yeah, of course. You know, but it was a very reformed.
Very different. It must have been. But by the way, tomorrow we're going to have the openly gay Episcopal Bishop Eugene Robinson. I hate to say openly gay Episcopal, but that's the first thing you should know about him, is that he's gay.
How about the openly Episcopalian gay bishop?
Bishop, there you go. Better? The openly
he's
Episcopalian
openly, he's
gay
brazenly
bishop.
Episcopalian.
Right.
Episcopalianly gay?
Yeah, the Episcopalian bishop who happens to be gay.
Oh, okay. How about okay. That? Did we figure out how we address a bishop?
I don't know. Bishop?
Is it father? Is it?
I don't think it's father. Father's like a regular parish.
Your bishopship? Bishopship.
Your bishopship. Yeah, I don't know. You don't say your worship or your holiness. I mean, that's a whole different thing.
Oh, you could use the general dude.
It's okay. We have about 24 hours. We'll figure it out.
Someone will email us with the standard sort of what are you guys, stupid? Yeah. What are you guys, naive?
Or duh.
I love the emails that start like that.
Yeah.
I think I have one here about something else we were talking about. Oh, that was, I don't know if we can transfer back into this. It was about, and I don't know if
the
we
want outsourcing.
No, it was before that. It was about us saying why no one has taken the hit within the administration. Why hasn't Rumsfeld been fired, or hasn't anyone stepped down with, Cambone or any
Did
of them?
Did Rumsfeld wear a sash to church?
Yeah, right. But here's one of these emails let us not be naive. Mm. Let us not. There are absolutely no checks and balances on this regime. They don't have to fire anyone. The Fourth Estate, the media, is in their pocket. Executive, legislative, and judicial are in their control. We are under their thumb until we shed this regime. If we can't rid our country of this gang of thugs in the people's house, we are in for even worse times. And I agree with that. They are planning on stealing the election again. Yes, God knows how that's going to happen. What are we, naive?
I'm thinking maybe...
Are we?
Can you say Diebold?
Diebold, or who knows what's going to happen, man? With the terrorist alert threat, I suspect them of the worst.
Well,
October Surpriseville.
We talked about that last week, and at least two magazine articles this week talk about whether or not that whole terror threat thing was political.
We didn't even talk about the missing Libyan, nuclear stuff.
Oh, that's from Libya, yeah.
Yeah, where's that stuff? How do you miss, like, you know, oh, yeah, we've misplaced some nuclear stuff. Well, could somebody find it?
Well, actually, they had purchased it. They hadn't gotten it yet, and it hasn't gotten there.
Oh, so it's a delivery problem.
It's a delivery problem. Yeah, they use FedEx.
Do they have a tracking number? Yeah, exactly.
I'm sorry. That's a terrible thing to say. Straight ahead, Tammy Faye Starlight helps us get religion. Plus, is there a new segment coming up?
I think there might be. Yeah,
Countdown to democracy. Oh. And, of course, the all-important liberal agenda. This is Air America Radio.
Good morning. It's Mark Maron here. I'm on Morning's Edition with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott on Air America Radio.
Hey,
what did you find out?
I found out how to address a bishop. I think if he's Episcopalian. What's his second name again?
Eugene Robinson.
So he's just Bishop Robinson.
So that's
Bishop
it?
It's really easy.
Bishop and Robinson. Here's to you, Bishop Robinson.
No, don't do that, though. We want him to stick through the segment.
Riley!
Thank you.
Riley with the Simon and Garfunkel joke. Perfect. Hey. So what do you get when you mix a little Tammy Wynette with Jesus Christ and stir in a bit of Wild Turkey? You get our next performer, who I've worked with on many occasions.
Bless your heart.
Yes, the wonderful Tammy Faye Starlight.
Thank you so much, Mr. Mary.
It's nice to see you. How's the crusade going?
Oh, it's wonderful. And, you know, we've reached so many Jews like yourself and changed them over to Jesus.
Yes, yes. I'm not going.
I think you are, but I think you don't know.
You've got a plan?
I have a plan that involves swallowing.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. Well, hey! Wow!
Well, because, as Jesus says, he says, get down on your knees, open your mouth in praise. And so that's what I do as I spread all around this great country of ours, or rather these 48 contiguous states.
Uh-huh.
Spreading the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. Bless your heart.
Oh, boy, the emails are coming in already.
To ask you a question, because I just heard about this yesterday on Mr. Chris Matthews' show. Uh-huh. Am I allowed to say that on this? Is that conflict of interest?
Chris Matthews is not... He's going to be on
our
show
tomorrow.
Yeah.
Is he really?
Yeah.
I'm so hot for him. I really am.
Yeah? Well, maybe tomorrow you can call in and... Well, he's actually going to be on the phone. We'll tell him.
I go backwards and forwards. So you could tell him that.
I will tell him that.
Okay.
And we'll send him to your website.
And other sites.
Okay.
My nether sites.
All right. Your nether...
Yes.
Oh, nice.
Oh, speaking of which, I wanted to ask, did you talk about cocks?
Oh, wait, which kind? I don't know.
The cocks who died.
Oh, no, we didn't.
You didn't talk about the cocks who died? Because when we lose cocks, it's a very sad day in America. Even if he did slander the name of one of our finest presidents, Mr. Richard Nixon, way back in the 1970s when you were in your early 20s.
No, yeah, we didn't talk about him, but I'm glad you brought it up.
I know. Well, I knew that I had to talk about cocks as soon as I heard about it.
Okay.
Sorry.
Tammy Faye Starlight is with us, the famous country revival singer. Are you going to do a song for us?
I think we will, because as you probably know, there is an election imminent.
When is that? In November?
I think that one? Well, probably November, unless we have to do a recount.
A recount, or they just suspend it completely.
I don't think we really need an election, do you?
Yeah, I think something needs to happen. Yes, I think
certainly we need 4 more years of Bush.
No, then
4 more years of Jeb.
Wait,
and then 4 more years of Lauren.
But wait,
and
I
then
can't.
4 more years of, who's the gay one?
Is there a gay Bush?
Yeah, the pretty boy son who's the kind of dark in a Mark Anthony kind of way.
Are you not talking about Ronald Reagan? Son, or are you talking
about? Oh no, he's very, very gay. But this one doesn't know he's gay yet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you're reaching out to him today.
I want to reach out to him and first off pull him over to the other side, because it's okay, in Christianity, I don't know if you know that it's all right to be gay as long as you are not gay.
Okay, I get it. So let's kick out the jams.
Oh, you want to kick out the... That's so hip. You are always... Mr. Maron, despite being a Jew, you are a very... Well, no, Jews are funny. That is your gift. That is... But, I didn't come here. I know.
She knows she's in New York.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, I know.
She does it all over the Lower East Side.
I do it all over, period. Even when I have my period. So.
Whoa. Yeah, nice.
So, I know, yes, it is nice, actually. It slides in very well.
Here we go.
Okay. Anyway, speaking of sliding in, this song, actually, I wanted to do because it's an issue that I hope will come up during the election, which is funny to say come up during. Anyway, this is a song because I know that y'all here, I mean, you have your very liberal viewpoints, but I do hope that you're against women shoving coat hangers up their insides and yanking out fetuses prior to their birth.
We're against that, yes. That would be a bad situation.
Yes, because I don't like, you know, there are so many women who walk around saying, you know, things like your body is your own and all this kind of stuff. And Mr. Bush is trying very hard to stop the abortion, to stop the killing of the innocent babies. Mm-hmm. And that's what this song is about. I wrote it actually when my mama, you know, when I grew up, my mama had, she got married at 15, and by age 26, she had 16 babies. And I often, you know, would see her walking around with child. And anyway, I'd say to her, Mama, why don't you just, you know, get a Hoover and just suck them out like all the other girls are doing? But she sang this song to me, and it's in the key of A for abortion. God has lodged a tenant in my uterus, and he's asked me to keep it safe and keep it warm. God forbid I should hurt it, kill it, or desert it. My placenta is its shelter from the storm. God has lodged a tenant in my uterus, and for 9 months he will pay its room and board. He will rent out my womb for the child that will bloom, and I will be its temporary landlord. I would feel such unease if I broke this holy lease, and my mind would never know a sense of peace. Or when the Lord is the lessee, I know that he has blessed me, and for that, I should get down on my knees. Because God has lodged a tenant in my uterus, and when it's born, he wants me to rejoice. I will feed it, clothe and clean it, I'll keep it till he redeems it. As a woman, I haven't any choice. No, as a woman, I haven't any choice.
Tammy Faye Starlight, you can get her CD at TammyFayStarlight.com. That's L-I-T-E.
Yes, like and, the adjective.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh,
it's a pleasure
you.
To see
and
you.
And this is Keith on guitar.
Very good job, Keith.
Yeah.
We're going to...
How many men named Keith have you slept with, Mark?
I don't sleep with men, but I used to worship Keith Richards.
Oh,
if that helps anything.
It helps a lot.
We're going to take some calls at 866-303-AAR0, 866-303-2270. Maybe some thoughts on the power of religion. Nah, it's too vague. Call us about whatever you want. Sedition at AirAmericaRadio.com. Come back here on Air America Radio. America. Yes. 45 past the hour. Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott on Air America Radio. We're taking your calls at 866-303-AAR0, 866-303-2270. The topic is religion and other things. See, we've got a couple of calls about religion, a couple of calls about my taste in movies. Right now we're going to try a new segment called Countdown to Democracy, June 1st. As the deadline for handover of power to the Iraqis approaches, we'd like to explore various issues and opportunities the Iraqis and Americans will face. Today's issue is choosing a president. Among the most important decisions a new democracy must make is choosing a president. But before you can have a disputed election and the resulting civil war, you must first have a disputed presidential appointment. Remember, it's a long road to theocracy. Just this morning, Ghazi Mashal Ajil Al-Yawir, the head of the Iraqi Governing Council, was named interim president by the Iraqi Governing Council. Iraq's getting the hang of this democracy thing already. Contain power into as small a group as possible. That keeps the will of the people safely out of the way. True, Al-Yawir isn't the president the Americans wanted. That's okay. A strong democracy can handle dissenting voices, at least for a few weeks, until Al-Yawir has that unfortunate accident or disease or change of heart. A good democracy is flexible. Immediately after the announcement, strong explosions repeatedly rock central Baghdad. No voter apathy here. That bodes well for the future. So congratulations, President Al-Yawir. Sorry, interim President Al-Yawir. Good luck, but I wouldn't spring for business cards. This is day 29 in our countdown to democracy. Live free or die. Bill,
that
in Maine.
Sad.
Bill, how are you, Bill?
And how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
You guys are crazy.
Yeah. Now, you're a former Catholic priest. Is that true?
I am. Yes, I am. I spent 9 years in the priesthood. Yeah.
And wow. we're crazy. So what do you have to tell us?
Well, I just, you know, the whole hypocrisy about the Catholic Church and homosexuality, it's like the seminary was the gayest place. I mean, I just came from the I just came from the international Mr. Leather competition in Chicago, and it wasn't as gay as the seminary, okay? So,
oh, you know, boy, we're recording this.
No wonder you're former.
Yeah. So, it's just ridiculous. It's so hypocritical. I mean, I can't tell you, like, I can't think of any straight people that went to the seminary with me. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Oh, my God. Thank you so much for your call.
Anyway, so I love your show, and I love what you're doing, and keep it up.
Thank you so much, Bill. You too. That was tremendous. Yes, that was great.
That's real deep.
What is it, Leatherman Convention? Mike in New Jersey. Mike, what's up? You want to fight or something?
Good morning, folks.
Hey, buddy.
Hey.
Great to talk to you.
Okay.
Mark, lay off the chocolate. Don't get so excited about a movie. First of all, it's out there to sell tickets.
All right.
But second of all, I saw the movie. And over the weekend, there were two news reports on Channel 2 and Channel 4.
Yeah.
In New York about global warming.
Okay.
And even though, you know, I think the movie gets people to think. But
do you really, though? Because, I mean...
But it was eerily simple. There was the first scene in A Day After Tomorrow where they're drilling through the ice flow.
Yeah.
And the ice flow breaks off.
Yes.
Well, the news report Saturday on one of the news stations showed about a Russian team drilling through the ice. This was in the Arctic.
Right.
And they woke up in the morning and an ice flow had broken off.
Okay.
Kind of similar.
I understand what you're saying. I just thought that the way they set the film up initially, you know, it was setting it up like it was going to have some science in it, but, you know, and some of the science may be true, but some of it seemed a little untrue. And I just don't know if it was that, you know, environmentally minded a movie. I just thought it became a melodramatic film, you know, set on a backdrop of this globally, you know, this apocalyptic idea. And it didn't really show anything other than, you know, a relationship between, you know, these few people. I just thought it was sappy and ridiculous.
What I got out of the movie is the fact that we have a delicate balance in the ecosystem.
Okay,
and
all right.
And it gets you to think about, you know, about what we do to our environment and what effect it's going to have on us and future generations. But you know what? It was like Independence Day, Men in Black, exciting movies, it sold tickets. And it almost overtook Shrek 2, an accomplishment on itself.
Well, thank you, Mike. Thanks for calling. You know, I understand what he's saying, but I did not walk out thinking, you know, wow, we've really got to, you know, watch, you know, for global warming.
I think it just goes to show that you can overthink a Hollywood movie.
Yeah, Dale in Kentucky. How are you, Dale?
Hey, fine. I hope you people speak Kentucky. If not, I can try a New Jersey accent.
What do you? As long as you can speak it quickly.
Okay. I'm a Christian. I don't think Bush is a Christian. My bracelet reads, "What would Jesus do?" Not "Who would Jesus bomb, kill, torture, and deceive?"
Right on. Thank you, Dale. We definitely speak that style of Kentucky.
Yeah.
Appreciate your call. Appreciate all your calls. We do have to get out of here for a commercial break. We will be back with the liberal agenda. And again, thanks for your calls. And I still didn't like the movie. Come back and listen to Air America Radio.
No moment couldn't go unmentioned in.
Mark Maron here. Good morning. This morning's edition on Air America Radio. I'm with Mark Riley and Sue Alcott. It's been quite a day.
Sure has.
Now I'm rethinking the whole morning, day after tomorrow. You know, whatever.
Day
I'm not.
Before yesterday.
I'm not really rethinking it that much. I think it was sappy, ridiculous movie. But I'm trying to, you know, dig into my soul right now to see if it made me any more aware of the consequences
of global warming.
Yeah, and I don't think it did. They mentioned it at the beginning, but once that stops, it's like just like, woo, look at that, ice. Whoa, my God. All right, we're going to do something we did earlier, but I got sort of cut off, but not really, but I wanted to make sure we did it, give it the right time, because I thought it was funny. This is Presidential Daily Briefing. This is our top secret classified document that we get from my guy in the Pentagon. Today's PDB from the intelligence community is titled, "Your Father Must Die." Mr. President, it has come to our attention that former President George H.W. Bush said the following to Time magazine. Quote, "The country is doing pretty darn well, but the war in Iraq is a large problem. There's a lot of what Jimmy Carter called malaise around." Malaise. "In our estimation, Bush Sr. just made four serious mistakes. One, he spoke to Time magazine. Two, he mentioned Jimmy Carter, a weak one-term president. Three, he said that your glorious war in Iraq was a problem. And four, he used the word malaise, which in addition to having negative overtones, is clearly French." It seems that the ex-president has become a loose cannon. It's time to think about taking him out. Now, we're aware of your special relationship with the former president, but consider the larger picture. The elimination of your father dovetails nicely with Mr. Rove's reelection strategy. It would eliminate a dissenting voice while at the same time creating a massive sympathy vote that would be difficult for the Kerry campaign to top. Think of it as a win-win. And from a practical standpoint, killing a 79-year-old man is relatively easy. We do it all the time. Respectfully, Office of Homeland Security, in a rather Greek dispatch. I think.
Mm. Well, you know, the elder Bush, who's been out of the news for like the last, 10 years or so?
Yeah, now Paul Azan interviewed him, and you've got a thing
back
there.
In the news now. He's not a big fan of Michael Moore. Like, this should come as some surprise. He was here in New York at the T.J. Martell Foundation Awards Gala with Stevie Wonder and others, and said, among other things, quote, "It's a free country, so he's free to say whatever he wants, but I don't appreciate it. I don't like it. It's a vicious attack on our son." And further down the road, he called him a slime ball.
I don't like it. I don't appreciate it. But you know what? I think Michael Moore is quite big enough in very many ways to take care of himself. I'm not too worried about Michael Moore.
In other words, go see the movie.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a
whenever
net plus
it opens,
for Michael Moore.
He's going to put that on the poster. George Bush said he's a slime.
Yep, absolutely.
Absolutely, that's great. They will do that.
Yeah. Well, I guess
I want to see the movie.
Maybe he's making up for the malaise thing.
Yeah, I'd like to see the film. Is there any information about it being released? Is it going to happen?
It has got distribution. I think I read somewhere last week there is going to be a distributor.
A lot of people were boycotting Disney, I think. There was a Disney boycott for a while because of what they did to Michael Moore in stopping the distribution or holding it up. But I'm glad to hear there's a distributor because it's information stuff. A lot of the stuff I'd read before, but I'm looking forward to seeing how he fleshed it out visually.
Who's the distributor? Is that Bandar Productions?
Bandar.
Right.
I didn't use my noising today.
You sure did.
Let me try
only
one.
Only by here mistake when you put your emails on there.
How dare they!
There's our liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Sorry. Here we go. Get your notebooks and your...
Boys and toys.
Yeah, and your pencils. One, pressure baby name book authors to include the name Osama. Two, criticize new Iraqi president until he defends a woman's right to choose. Three, thwart will of the people using activist judges. Four, find out where new Iraqi president stands on gay marriage, recycling, and funding for outsider art. Five, invite a renegade cleric to brunch. There you go.
There you go.
Very conciliatory.
That's it. Let me try one of these.
That's what H.W. would have done to Michael Moore if he had the chance.
That was the day after tomorrow.
Right. Coming up on tomorrow's morning's edition, we're going to play hardball with Chris Matthews. Plus, we're going to play softball with openly gay Bishop Gene Robinson. That's tomorrow's morning's edition here on Air America Radio.